Why are monsters so erotic? Smooches. Today, we're talking to writer and researcher Ella Gallego, who created the Monstrous Desire Study, and we take a deep dive into why it is that we are so drawn to creatures that go bump in the night. We talk about her own introduction to the monster fucking genre and why historically and in a resurgence of popular culture, we are seeing people be more open to about their attraction to monsters.
Hi, Meg.
Hi, Liz.
So we're very scholarly on this podcast.
Yeah, I feel like so freaking smart right now.
Yeah, we're really, really smart, educated, literate. And today we are talking to a scholar of monster fucking, which is just like the dream. Hi.
This is, am I saying your last name right? Gallego?
Yeah, you can say Gallego or Gallego. Both are correct.
Cool. So you've heard us talk about her work with the Monstrous Desire study on here more than once. So we're really excited to talk with Ella today.
Hello, I'm so excited to be here.
So let's just talk a little bit about your study. And did you start it as part of a PhD program?
So it's a complicated, not so complicated answer. The long answer is that I was doing my master's program in 2021. I was getting my master's in publishing studies. Do not recommend, but part of that, my dissertation was defining the genre of dark romance and also trying to create a cohesive ethnography. So who is this, who is the readership? And so as part of that, I also kind of grouped in monster romance. So part of that study opened the door for that. But the genesis for the Monstrous Desire study came about, and I think this is the genesis of it all, is feels so silly. I watched a movie with a friend called The Lighthouse in 2019.
Is that the
And
Robert Pattinson,
it
Willem Dafoe
is,
one?
yes, lots of cum, lots of dicks, lots of ginormous mermaid vaginas.
Wow.
I didn't
Yeah.
know. I thought it was just a
Oh.
movie about two guys fishing or something.
No, it is like if you want to like really boil it down, it is like two guys in a lighthouse. Like, but and maybe they kiss. Yeah, I it's literally like I am so obsessed that I actually got like a tattoo like from it. Like I'm so, like Robert Pattinson, I'm pretty certain there's like 20 minutes of footage of him like masturbating for this film. Like
Wow.
it's chef's kiss, perfect, perversions galore, just jism everywhere. And so I watched this movie in 2019 with a friend, and it changed my world. It changed my world. I had never watched a movie that had left me so repulsed and like bothered, and like everything in me just felt like it had slid sideways. And so I talk about
This
this
is
on
a
my blog.
powerful thing.
Yeah, I mean, and like when I try to show friends this movie, they're like, half of them are like, whoa, that was so cool. And the other half are like, wow, that was a movie.
Yeah.
But like it spoke so viscerally to me, because I think that The Lighthouse truly understands like the grotesque and why that is something that rejects and like lures us in, and especially in relation to like sexuality and how that can be like a metaphor for sexuality and being like haunted by queerness, haunted by desire. Monstrosity is such a perfect vacuum for exploring that. And so, you know, that movie, like I was so obsessed with it. Like I wrote an entire essay that I still need to get back to and to edit it down so that I can publish it finally. But I wrote an entire essay of going down the rabbit hole of like, what is our attraction to the other? Like, that is distinctly kind of what this movie is about. It's about desire, about otherness, about, you know, this magnetic push and pull towards the other. And ever since then, I have not pulled myself back out of that rabbit hole whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So the Monstrous Desire study is specifically about those of us who throughout the centuries have been drawn to monsters and what could be erotic about the other. So what is it that made you ask that question, and like, how have you been answering it? How have you been doing research?
Yeah, so I think that like it feels paradoxical on a surface level of like being attracted to, and not just like on a desire level, but just on a like baseline fascination to the grotesque.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like that's kind widely of, defining attraction.
Right, right. Like being drawn towards something grotesque, something that scares you. And, you know, when you do research like on a theory basis for like horror, people love horror because mm-hmm. they love being scared. People love to be like spooked. People love to have almost in a sense of like a brush with death, but in a very controlled and safe environment, a recognition of like immortality. And, you know, you get that through, you know, various genres within horror. For me, I really wanted to tackle this question of like, what is it about the other that has fascinated us for so long? And I really wanted to understand, like, you know, what are the variables involved in this? You know, how does sexuality affect our desire towards the other, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of like heterosexual people versus homosexual people? Mm-hmm. How does like gender, how does race, all these facets, which are so intrinsic to the monster, because the monster is that which is other, that mm-hmm. which reveals. Mm-hmm. It is that which is always on the periphery of society, and it lacks categorization, you know, easy categorization for that reason. And most importantly, the monster is a cultural body. It is a cultural mm-hmm. embodiment of fears, desires, anxieties. And so a lot of times you have a lot of marginalized people who are monstrous sized.
Yeah, when we define what is monstrous, we are de facto defining what we say is normal.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And so like you can see that throughout time in terms of who people have deemed monstrous, or even in mm-hmm. media, how monstrosity is conveyed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I really wanted to get into the nitty gritty. And then, you know, when I started reading historically as well, I noticed that there was just like a very long history of this, which really made me feel incredibly vindicated. Vindication. The first book, which really just like cinched this project into like, this is it, was the book. Oh my God, how am I blanking on my book? It's right in front of me. It's called Demon Lovers, The Witchcraft, Sex, and the Crisis of Belief. And this book specifically talks about how the crisis of belief during the medieval and Renaissance period in Europe could have possibly created, you know, witchcraft hysteria. Mm-hmm. And that was innately tied a lot of times to demon copulation mm-hmm. accusations. And it's not just like, you're a witch, you know, I saw you fucking the devil. Like, they go into deep detail about like the devil's cock, by the way, he's got three of them, and also it's made out of a horn, and also like they go into detail about all of this insane shit. And this was a moment where I was like, you people are insane. I'm vindicated. Good for me. So, you know, that was part of it. And the other part, of course, was my survey. I did a survey which got over 2,202 respondents. Bananas. I don't even know that many people.
Yeah.
And you know, part of that was, again, trying to understand perhaps culturally right now, if the monster, vague monster, is a cultural body, you know, what is the ethnography behind that cultural body towards its attraction? So with these two facets, I've been trying to merge them and to kind of show in an overarching zoom out picture about, you know, the cultural influences of the erotic monster.
Yeah, totally. I think my first introduction to the idea that like monster fucking is a much older history than I expected was, I was just looking it up while you were talking. It's a painting. It's a Japanese painting from like the early 1800s. It's called The Dream of the Fisherman's Wife.
Yeah, I talk about that in one of my blog posts. I do. Yeah, I have a whole thing about that.
I became familiar with it through Mad Men, and I was like, yes, I have to know more about this painting. It's incredible.
The idea behind that, the genesis behind The Dream of the Fisherman's Wife, is actually really fascinating. And I think the cultural significance of a tentacle erotic art in Japan, like having tentacle rape today being such a prevalent genre, you would think they're connected, but they're not.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Crazy. Yeah, the person behind the tentacle rape genre is Maeda, the master of tentacle rape. Mm-hmm. And so in 2015, if I'm remembering correctly, someone asked him in an interview if he had ever seen The Dream of the Fisherman's Wife, if he'd ever seen these shunga. And there are multiple pieces of artwork, erotic artwork, during the Edo period, specifically about tentacle play. Mm-hmm. The Dream of the Fisherman's Wife is one of the most prominent, because it's by Kanagawa, who did
The Great Wave.
Correct, The Great Wave. And, you know, an interview asked him, like, had you seen that? Like, is that what the influence is for tentacle rape? And Maeda responded pretty much with, like, no, I was, like, a kid. Like, why would people ever show me that? Like, he's like, I didn't see that well until later on in, like, adulthood. Like, that was no sort of significance to me. So the fact that, you know, it's a little bit like if I had a nickel for every time Japan had two instances of erotic tentacle art in their history, I would have two nickels. Mm-hmm. It's kind of strange it happened twice, but nonetheless, cool that it did.
So your more contemporary research is based on this survey that you did. How do you approach your historical research?
Whatever throws me down a rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a lot of rabbit holes. This week I have been researching monstrous feminine. So how have women been monstrosized, and how has that played out within media? I got to dabble a little bit in Freud and all of his coke addicted insanity. Mm-hmm. Especially with the vagina dentata, which is the vagina with teeth. If anybody's seen the movie Teeth, that's what
that
is. And the fascinating thing about that, when you go down that rabbit hole, and boy is it deep, is that when you think about all of the big name like female monsters that we know, mm-hmm. A lot of them are calling upon the motif of the vagina dentata, mm-hmm. which is, according to Freud and authors like Barbara Creed, it is supposed to embody the like male fears around castration and mm-hmm. mutilation. And so you have monsters like Skyla, who has like the hellhounds at her waist, snapping hellhounds. You mm-hmm. have Medusa's also supposed to be, you know, part of the vagina dentata. Female vampires specifically are a very big reference to the vagina dentata, mm-hmm. because a lot of times within media, you have like a close up of their like mouth, and it's like bloody, and there's fangs, and
mm-hmm. yeah.
And so that led me then down the rabbit hole of lesbian female vampires and like their significance within movies, and how, you know, of during the 70s, for example, how almost half of the movies during that period were supernatural horror. And of those supernatural horror, a very large chunk were just lesbian vampire movies. weird thing to just go down the rabbit hole of that and spiral and be like, what do you mean you made a movie called Vampirus Lesbos? What do you mean you came out with a movie called Vampire Hookers? Like I need to sit with that for a minute.
What do you mean they aren't showing in a double feature every single weekend?
What do you mean that Hammer Films, the original production who did the Dracula series with Christopher Lee, who was one of the biggest, one of them, you know, Dracula figures, then went on to create a Carmilla trilogy, three of them, of lesbian vampires, bush and everything, gauze, boobs, lots of lesbian sex.
And I feel like the 70s were a heyday for bush and film.
It was. God bless him. But also,
R.I.P.
Yeah, so with the whole lesbian vampire thing and with female monsters being related to vagina dentata is the conceit basically like men fearing women being more powerful than them, and like the most literal way to depict that is she could bite your dick off.
Yes.
And also like lesbians don't need your dick, so they might as well bite it off.
Right. There's something really interesting about that, actually, in which there's a lot of circulation like of why lesbian vampires were so prominent during the 70s and then they just died out. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple academics who are of the mindset that the lesbian vampire horror film came out as a reactionary culture against second wave feminism. And so what you had was men who were taking, because all of these films, most of them relied heavily on lesbophobic and misogynistic tropes about like the female vampire being a sexual predator, the female vampire, you know, like she was sexually forward, you know, she was a predator. She would literally lure women away from heterosexuality, these structures, and these women would happily follow. And then if
they must be bewitched.
What's going on here? So a lot of this is a lot of people, a couple academics are of the mindset that the female, like that the lesbian vampire was supposed to be an object that could be fetishized, and an object that could be kind of like neutralized, because in the end, despite her always being a threat in these movies, in the end of these movies, she was always murdered. She was killed. Right. She was beheaded. She was staked, whatever. Mm-hmm. So in the end, this evil force was always overcome. But I think the beauty of the monster is that it always returns. And it shows that like within this obsession, like within the 70s itself, she always did return in some facet. Mm-hmm. And so there's, like I said, that's why the monster is like a cultural body. Like, where does the lesbian vampire of the 70s come from? Mm-hmm. Maybe it came from a reactionary culture of the patriarchy feeling threatened that they will be replaced, that patriarchy itself and heterosexuality is being threatened. I don't know. It's always great food for thought.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about this idea of prey and predator. ContraPoints recently put out a 3-hour video about Twilight, and it was a goddamn masterpiece.
and I only saw a little bit of it, but I was like, amazing.
Yeah, just like the depth of research that went into it, and just like things that really like changed the way that I think, not just about the monster fucking genre, but about romance in general. Sure. And one thing she said that I thought was really interesting was, this is not a story about becoming prey. This is a story about rising to the level of prey, because Bella becomes a powerful vampire after being a very weak woman. So kind of pushing back on that idea of Twilight as this like really regressive text by a very regressive author. And a lot of her video was about how Twilight is a lot kinkier than Stephanie Meyer probably realized.
The cuck tent.
The cuck tent. I Dude, lost my
Stephanie
mind.
Meyer is obsessed with cuckolding. Obsessed with it. Like, yeah. Girl, why does it appear multiple times in a young adult's, like, series?
Yeah.
Multiple, like, why does Edward in Breaking Dawn get on his knees to beg to Jacob, if my wife aborts our demon child, you can impregnate her? Why was that? Are we, like, hello?
And then, like, the fact that Bella, and this is something that ContraPoint pointed out, that I was like, oh my fucking God, that Bella can't be polyamorous, but she has forced a monogamous commitment from both these men, but the one with Jacob is vicariously through her daughter, which is like levels upon levels of
therapy.
Of, like, yes.
One of the Cullens needs to become a therapist because they all need it.
Yeah. So all of that is to say, I've heard people talk about the monster genre being interesting because women who are attracted to men are attracted to their only natural predator. So then, like, where does the desire for an actual predator, like a visible predator, come from when that's something that, like, we want to avoid in real life?
I think that there's baseline thrill, you know, you're excited by, like, the thrill of power, the brush of death. But
you also were talking about, like, experiencing it in a sort of contained or, like, safe way. Mm-hmm. And sure. That's another thing that we talk about a lot, which is, like, things yeah. that we would tolerate or never tolerate in real life
right.
can be it's titillating when you're reading about it and it's contained.
Right. You know, there's a fantastic piece called Monster Culture, Seven Theses by Jeffrey Jerome Cohen. And one of his theses is called Fear of the Monster is Really a Kind of Desire. And I'll just, right here, I have it, which is the same creature who terrifies and interdicts can evoke potent escapist fantasies. The linking of monstrosity with the forbidden makes the monster all the more appealing as a temporary egress from constraint. But I think that I don't know if I agree with ContraPoints. I didn't see it, but from what I hear, I don't know if I agree with that, really. I think that when we're dealing with heterosexuality, especially with the romance genre, what you're seeing is a lot of how two figures within heterosexuality deal with these power structures and a lot of the anxieties. And in some instances, you have escapist fantasies of people being like, he's the perfect man. This monster loves me. It doesn't, you know, is not a part of the patriarch in terms of, like, tries to contain me, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's those escapist fantasies. I think that if we stay in line with the monster being a cultural figure, Edward Cullen is 1,000% an embodiment of cis hetero patriarchy anxieties for Stephanie Meyer. 1,000%. There's a really great reading that I have on this that I can't remember who it is right now, but she talks about how explicitly Twilight is nothing more but her anxieties pertaining to a system being what she perceives as threatened. And Edward is kind of, she coins it as being faux gothic. You know, the gothic is that which subverts. And monstrosity fits very nicely into that. That, you know, because monstrosity is that which threatens, it subverts, it scares you, you know? And Edward Cullen is, she argues, is not a monster, really. He's constantly described as an angel, in fact.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. she can't even commit to her own monstrosity, in fact. Like, he's a vegetarian who, like, drinks the blood of, like, deer.
Yeah.
And her argument is rather, the monstrous thing is Bella's desire. It's this thing that she can't control. It's this thing. But, yeah, isn't that interesting? I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it when academics pull something out like that, and you're like, oh, you're going out.
Oh, you ate with that one.
Yeah,
I ate with that one. Shit. And so her argument is that Bella's desire is actually the monstrous thing that needs containment, that needs, you know, it's constantly haunting her. And Edward, to a certain extent, You know, and Edward Cullen, I think that when we're talking about the romance genre, it is such a complicated thing of, I don't necessarily think that it is inherently progressive. I don't think that it is necessarily like, what's the opposite of progressive? I'm blanking on the
regressive.
Yeah, exactly.
Conservative.
I think that what we're seeing is different facets of heterosexuality as a regime and how people deal with that, how women specifically engage with that. And I was just talking with a friend recently about this, which is like, I kind of feel almost a sort of grief when engaging with like heterosexual romance genre, because like, even when the man is perfect, like women's dreams of the perfect man is someone who like puts her feelings first, cares about her sexuality, like her orgasm, like bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, it's like so fucking grim.
Bar is on the ground, and it's so depressing to a certain extent.
That is still the critique of that's like unrealistic expectation.
Yeah, right.
Because the truth of the matter is that heterosexuality is a violent regime. It is a violent, violent regime that a lot of people need escape as fantasies from. But I do think that in a lot of instances, like sexual pleasure, instead of it destroying patriarchy or going against the grain, sometimes I think that it is just simply folded within the structure. And so, again, this is a long answer for me to say that, like, the monster is a cultural body. So when we're engaging with a cultural body of heterosexuality, I think there's tons of nuance to be had, you know, maybe like I haven't seen the ContraPoints video. And like,
for the record, I think that I did a terrible job stating what she said. Because like a lot of what you're saying is about Bella and like the monstrosity and her stuff that she talks about. So.
And I think that, we always have to keep that in mind when we're engaging with this sort of media and how the monster is conveyed or portrayed. Because the monster is inherently political. It's always saying something. If it is a cultural body, it is always saying something. So what does it mean in all of these instances? What is it saying?
Yeah, and it was interesting to hear you talk about the lesbian vampire in the 70s and like responding to the zeitgeist and the fears of that time. And I know that it's something that you have discussed with regard to your survey, is that you feel like it's somewhat limited because your respondents were mostly of a certain demographic.
Sure.
But I'm interested in what you've learned about that certain demographic, like the zeitgeist that we are in, and how that has shaped what we think about monsters. And the monsters that we like.
Yeah. So like I'm so grateful, and I think that my survey is fantastic. I have 2,202 people take it. Yeah. That's amazing.
That's amazing.
I do think, and I always try to tell people to take it with a grain of salt, because, you know, to get those respondents, I reached out to a ton of people who had large platforms who were so, so kind to be like, of course I'll engage with your silly little project. And so, I reached out to so many people who are on BookTok and Bookstagram. And, you know, these are people who are romance readers predominantly. That's what the monster romance genre falls under. It's the monster, it's the romance genre.
Yeah.
And so these are people who predominantly, like, I reached out to Ruby Dixon, the author Ruby Dixon, and she was like, yeah, of course I'll like circulate this in my Facebook group. And overnight I got over 1,000 respondents. Like, God bless you, Ruby, you beautiful angel. It is, however, a double-edged sword, because I had all these people taking the survey, and then I realized, oh, I think that the demographic that is coming through right now, whether or not it is reflective of people being attracted to monsters, is the romance genre. And that is a distinct demographic that like has been studied over and over again. It is, you know, it's white heterosexual women, young, which is kind of reflected in the data. Mm-hmm. And so what needs to happen is I need to then do a second survey of equal or larger standing and try to go to different spheres of the internet, perhaps, mm-hmm. to see, like, all right, does this confirm or deny my data? Like, what's going to go on? Like, if I go to Tumblr, for example, which is a whole other ballpark, you know, are my respondents going to be more queer? Are my respondents going to be more diverse? Is it going to deviate from the demographic that I have currently? So when you ask about, like, what culture are we seeing with this survey, I think we're seeing the romance genre.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say, like, oh, this throw the baby out with the bathwater, this, you know, survey is crap. Doesn't mean anything. It's just take it with a grain of salt. This is my hypothesis. Mm. And I can't wait for it to be proven wrong or right.
Uh-oh. Meg, you're muted. Meg.
Oh, or something's up.
Uh-oh. Oh, no!
What's happening?
How about now?
Yeah.
Woo! Okay. We're back.
Woo! There's a particular section of your survey responses that I really loved, which was talking about first monster crushes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for some of us, that was like our first crush period.
Right.
So, like, right. Are you normal or was your first crush an animated monster?
Like, yeah.
So right. I was really interested in that data. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So a lot of them are reference points to media that mm-hmm. something that like Gen Z and millennials engaged with. Yeah. So which isn't to say that like older people don't, like, again, the 70s had nothing but lesbian porn. You're talking, like, you're telling me Peepaw didn't find any of the lesbian vampires hot, like, whatever. Anyway, Peepaw's just not on Instagram taking my survey. So the first monstrous crush is interesting because you know, I think the first one was Beauty and the Beast, which, yeah. Like, I always say this, and I love to reiterate it, and now I feel even better because I did the research behind Beauty and the Beast, and again, vindication. I watched Beauty and the Beast, and I was never like, that beast can get it. but, like, when he changed
but to he a could human, have.
They made him ugly, and I was like, well, I don't want that. Like, why did you make him look like that?
Like, I had this conversation with my book club last month, and I felt like nobody was understanding me. I'm like, way hotter as the Beast.
He's way better as the Beast. As a human, he's weird looking. They made him like Uncanny Valley. Like, they put too much detail, and I'm like, he's weird looking. Why does he look like that? So,
Liz, you know, do you disagree?
I do disagree. I think he's hot. I do. In his defense, he got like three frames of human, and him, he was just making this face like, oh, I no longer have paws.
That is a really strong argument. Your Honor, maybe human Beauty and the Beast, we were too hard on him.
Maybe, but you know, like the beast has like a lot of good qualities as well.
Mm-hmm. He made her a library.
That's he cool. did make her a library.
Pretty cool.
I had to explain to my husband the other day when I was shopping for bookshelves the idea, like, you know, of the library ladder and like why that's romantic. Like important to women of my generation, like mm-hmm. we want a ladder that we can slide
so she can
like
slide that. Across while you yeah. sing. Or you hold your most favorite book,
yes.
And then an old man says, you can keep it. Yes. It's yours.
It's important. Yeah.
Thank you kindly, old sir. Amazing.
In your own library. Yeah. But the top three were really interesting. So, you know, you had Beauty and the Beast, Twilight, obviously, duh. And people were, that I just threw in Twilight because you had people who obviously were either only Edward,
mm-hmm.
or just mm-hmm. the Cullens in general, mm-hmm. you know, like Emmett, Daddy Carlisle, Confederate Jasper. and then sometimes, obviously, they would be like the pro wolves, or some people are like both. Just throw that in the category of Twilight. Just, and
yeah.
you go.
Yeah.
And then the third one was the 80s television show Gargoyles, which again, I feel like I'm like a Luddite or something because like I did not watch Gargoyles. So
I didn't either.
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, they were hot.
There it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
There it is. And but I saw the clip for it and I was like, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, why did they make Damona look like that? Like that. Obviously, they're have you seen the meme where it's like writers barely disguised fetish?
Yeah.
it would be instead of writers, it would just be like illustrators barely disguised fetish for something like that. Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of really interesting points that, you know, as like a first crush. What was the other ones? I'm trying to think here.
I see Interview with the Vampire and Dracula on here. Those were two. I mean, the Gary Oldman, is that who does Dracula? Who's like 90s hot.
Francis Ford Coppola. Yeah. That is perhaps, it's not the, I always say it's the horniest version of Dracula, but I actually stand corrected because they made a ton of pornography featuring Dracula. So technically not the horniest, but again, the 70s.
Yeah.
The 70s was a weird time. But it is, in my opinion, like, you know, you have Jonathan Harker almost getting consumed in an orgy with Dracula's wives. Mm-hmm. Amazing. You have the scene where I believe it's not Mina. It's the other one.
Oh, the red-haired one. Or blonde-haired, yeah.
Yeah, or red-haired. I can't either. It slipped my mind. But she's impassionately embracing with like the werewolf version of Dracula. Uh-huh. And then of course there's a romantic scene between Dracula and Mina, you know, when they're like sharing blood and he's, you know, embraced back with her. Uh-huh. That's of course. But Dracula has, and this is written about on my blog, which is Dracula has a super long history of just having an erotic appeal, starting during 1931 with Bela Lugosi's Dracula, and which they marketed it as the strangest passion the world has ever known. You know, and they released it on Valentine's Day, and it was to woo women into the theaters to be like, oh, this is exciting, some guy's gonna be nibbling on your neck, like, and it worked. You know, it did really, really well. And then, you know, from 1930s onward, and then in 1950s, you had Christopher Lee, in which they literally hired Christopher Lee because he was a stud, quote unquote. And they were like, women, they literally hired him because they knew that women wouldn't mind if, you know, Christopher Lee was nibbling on their neck. You know, he was this dark, brooding figure who really understood that, you know, Dracula was a romantic, tragic anti-hero. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all throughout time, Dracula has had quite the chokehold on cinema, especially erotically. And, you know, that clearly still showcases because people were like, yes, Gary Oldman's. But it wasn't just Gary Oldman's, you know, you had the Christopher Lee, you had all different iterations of Dracula. So I just threw Dracula. And Interview with a Vampire, obviously, around this time, I believe the first season of the AMC series had come out.
I haven't watched it yet.
I've heard it's amazing.
So good. If you want to watch a nefarious twink do nefarious things constantly, watch it.
I do love a nefarious twink.
That's the only genre of twink that I know. Nefarious. Like,
the blonde one is the nefarious one, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, technically they are both nefarious, but the blonde one especially, he's French. It's automatic. It's in his blood to be a nefarious.
Oh, yeah.
He's French. He's French. Automatically, his biggest sin is already being evil, not because he's a vampire. So he interviewed with the vampire. But, like, people shit on the movie. I love the movie. I think Tom Cruise is great when he gets a little silly with it. Like, he plays Lestat. And it was so shocking at the time that Oprah Winfrey, who was a friend with Tom Cruise at the time, went to go see it and walked out because it was too gory. And she was like, this is like she said, direct quote, like, this is evil. This is putting an evil energy into like the world. Like, I will not partake in this.
Oh, like she did with Dr. Oz and Dr. Phil.
Evil energy.
Exactly. So, and it strained her relationship with Tom Cruise because she was like, no.
Oh, God. So, she must have been disinvited from the Scientology mixer.
Yeah. So, I think it's a load of fun. I highly recommend watching the movie. It's lots of fun. It's the subtext of, you know, the queerness between them. It is subtext, whereas in the AMC show, they pretty much say subtext is for losers.
Mm-hmm. It's just text.
It's just the text.
That's what I like. That's what I want to see more of.
Yeah.
It's great. I highly recommend both. So understandable for this to be, you know, a cultural reference for first crushes.
Yeah.
And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I think the one that really shook me up was, if you see it right now, is Alien on there, the Xeno Queen?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That one shook me up a little bit. I was like, wow, you are the real OG. Like, you, I'm an imposter. We're all an imposter. You, me. However, I was also going down the rabbit hole for that. And apparently they are vindicated because the set design and the character's design for Alien was created by H.R. Giger, who was a Swiss architect and artist who dabbled in the genre of like cybersexual. So it was this genre that like included like the biological with the cyber. It was like this morphing of the two. It's grotesque. It's tons of pipes and like wires, and I don't know if
tangled wires.
I don't know if either of you are like Tool fans, but like the
yes.
Mm-hmm. So you know Tool's covers. That's H.R. Mm-hmm. Giger. He did. Okay. He does a couple of those.
Okay. Yeah.
So they're freaky. They're really freaky. Mm-hmm. He was the person who did all of the set design. He did all of the character design for Alien, and his whole thing was about like eroticizing the abject, that which terrifies. Mm-hmm. And so there's so much like the xenomorph has like super phallic like design, and you know, there's the whole idea of the face hugger, you know, like penetrating, like it's all very sexual. Mm-hmm. So those monster factors have been very much vindicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we already talked about my first crush accidentally, which was Beast. Mm-hmm. Liz, what was your first monster crush?
I'm having a really hard time thinking of one. And you know, like, I don't know if I had, okay, I feel like there's something here, mm-hmm. But not consciously, because as we're talking about it, I'm like, what was my first monster crush? And I kept thinking about Fern Gully.
And that was also included.
Yeah, about mm-hmm. Hexus. I was looking it up during them. Like, did I as a child, like, was I attracted to this? Because I remember being really scared of it, but now like I'm looking at it and I'm like, I mean, they like, why is he kind of thick though? You know? Like so maybe that.
Not alone. Yeah. I mean, you go to, so the song that he sings, Oil and Wine, like if you go to YouTube and you mm-hmm. look it up, again, Fern Gully was not a movie I watched. I apparently lived under a rock. So I went to go look up Fern Gully and Hexus, and mm-hmm. I looked up his song, and the first comment in YouTube for it was like, this song got me pregnant. Like, like just listening to it. So like, there you go.
Okay, I'm gonna have to, I don't remember anything about Fern Gully other than him, but not like any of the music or anything. So I'm gonna
he oozes sexuality because
like,
it
yeah,
is,
he fucks.
It is Mr. Oh my God, I see him in my head. Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Tim Curry.
Oh.
Tim Curry is his voice.
Okay, then yes. Tim Curry, then, yes, I was attracted to Hexus because I'm very attracted to Tim Curry. So yeah.
Understandably.
So that one. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Completely.
All right, Ella, can you reveal your first monster crush or an early one?
I feel very similarly to Liz in that, like, I don't know if I can, like, remember one specifically. I remember being really obsessed with the movie Hellboy with Ron Perlman. Hellboy's great, but that's because it's Ron Perlman. He's got, you know, he's charismatic as hell. So I think I'll stick with Hellboy. I like that answer.
Yeah,
I do.
And I noticed that you had part of your survey where you were talking about, like, what monstrous features we like versus don't like fur or wings. Is there anything in that that kind of, like, surprised you?
Not necessarily. People seem pretty straightforward about, like, they like fangs, they like wings. I think the weirder things get, the more scattered the responses are about, like, if they're cool with it or not. Because I also think it's, like, contextual as well. Like, for me, like, it's not the fact that, like, I see tentacles and I'm like, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. you know, I think it also is... for a lot of people in relation to, like, the monster. So that's
like the plot very... might matter.
Right, but for some monster fuckers it does not. They are attracted to the scary monster, and, you know, I've been again showing my cards about apparently just living under a rock. I was not a Tumblr person growing up. I did neither not was have I. a Tumblr. Okay, thank you. Oh, I feel so much better.
I once tried to, like, start one, and I felt like such a boomer. And I was, like, in I couldn't figure out. I literally couldn't figure out how to use the platform. It was, like, making a WordPress website level.
That is
difficulty.
Me right now. It's atrocious. But I like, want to be a part of it so badly because there's so much there. Yeah, and so, like, when you step onto, like, Tumblr, for example, it's a whole other ballpark. It is a whole other ballpark. Yeah. You got some real believers in there that I'm like, oh, yeah, oh my.
It was very difficult to do my Gaylor research not being good at Tumblr. That's where a lot of the data is.
I reference trying to be a part of Tumblr now as it's like a sinking ship. I'm like, it would be akin to me missing getting on the Titanic, like, as it sailed away, and then somehow getting another ship to meet it the night before it and get on it to be like, I'm aboard, guys. This was bad timing. Bad timing. The vibes are off. Poorly, but I am trying to have a good time while I am there. Highly recommend people who, you know, Liz, if you can figure it out. I'm just smashing buttons. I don't know if I'm doing anything, but I'm having a good time.
I'll tell you, I've been smashing buttons the last 2 days trying to figure out how to Twitch stream, because I want to stream the Stardew Valley update, and I'm so confused, and I'm like, I'm too old for this shit.
Yeah, there's a lot of technology that I'm like, that's beyond me, my capabilities, my mentality.
It's like you have to be a computer programmer to, like, figure out how to get your little, like, webcam where the game is.
Not a fan. That's a pass. So, yeah.
What were some of the, like, more divisive monster features that you mentioned? Like, where did tentacles fall on the survey? Since that one comes up a lot.
Where do tentacles fall on the survey? That's great. Let me look that up right now. Data results.
I mean, wings was really high up there. Fangs, really high up there. The tentacles / gills / scales is still, like, pretty popular. I'm just looking at your, like, pie charts here.
Yeah. I tried, though. I kind of say that the monster romance genre of like readers were the predominant people who took this. I did try my hardest to reach out to as many different social spheres as possible. So Let's see what's divisive. I would say probably non-traditional amount of features. What's most divisive?
Like more than two eyes.
Yeah. More than two arms.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So like spiders come to mind, but again, you would be surprised at how much spider erotica, spider monster erotica there is on. I mean, isn't Tiffany Roberts has
Tiffany? Yeah, about, that one's very popular. Yeah,
I have not read it yet.
Neither have I, but I should probably. Yeah, there's a spiderweb shibari situation that happens.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And then another one was non-human facial features like Minotaur,
right?
Minotaur or Mothman.
Yeah, right. The Mothman beak we've talked about when we did I'm in love with Mothman and I'm engaged to Mothman, where I was like, I don't want like the beak form. And Molly was like, I think I do.
Yeah, she does. She was like, I want to put my mouth over the beak. To each their own.
Each their own. Yeah. And I think, again, that's such a hard question to ask because, like, there are some non-human facial feature creatures that I'd be like, yeah, like Minotaur, yeah. But, like, there are some non-human facial feature creatures that I've seen on Tumblr that I'm like, oh, no.
No.
No. So I think that's a complicated... I wonder how I could... You know, like, not all monsters are made equal, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's hard to categorize them by features because you could say yay to some and nay to others.
Mm-hmm. Context.
Yeah, context. A monstrosity, again, like, if it is the cultural body, it is also a contextual one very much so.
Yeah. So what's next for Monstrous Desire, the study or your research in general, and, you know, what should people watch out for?
Yeah, so the Monstrous Desire study is in the process of being made into a book. Woohoo! I know, it's huge, huge news. The blog is to keep me accountable for writing. So what you see will be probably included in the book. It's just like a rough draft version of what the book will later on be. And currently, my agent and I are waiting to hear back from publishers. We sent it out in January, so we will be hearing back, hopefully, in spring. So we are hearing back from publishers soon. But the fact, I'm banking, hopefully, on the fact that there is quite literally nothing academically about the research of monster fucking. Nothing. Which is so bizarre, considering, like, if my data has shown anything, it is so prevalent forever in every culture.
Forever.
Mm-hmm. Ever. Like, there's not a single culture that wasn't like, yeah, fuck that. All of them. But academically, people just have not written anything about it, which is where I come into play. So I'm hoping that publishers won't be stupid and will be like, wow, there is a market for this here. As it stands, I am trying to diversify the ways in which people can engage with the study, because I know that maybe some people don't want to read a wall of text. So I also have my podcast, which, yes, I only have one episode. I am bad. But the second episode will be coming out this month, in which I reached out to a couple monster sex toy businesses and I talked to them, like Creature Feature Toys and Dark Path. So I talked to both of them about their businesses. And so that will be coming out this month. Very exciting. Yes, yes, yes.
Wow, I can't wait.
Yeah. And of course, I will be having to do a second survey in the Forbes foreseeable soon future, because it's not science if you don't confirm or deny your findings.
Yeah.
So I will have to do a second one to see what's going on.
Will anyone be able to participate in that survey?
Yes, anyone will be able to participate. I will be trying to reach out to people predominantly on Tumblr if I can figure it out. I will be trying to, but I will be obviously hitting up Instagram. I will just be trying to rely more so on other spheres to try and circulate to see if you know, is it is it the demographic that I'm hitting up, or is this just what it is? You know, it could just be that.
Right.
The predominant demographic of monster romance are middle-aged, or not middle-aged, young white women, could be.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's a reflection of the romance genre. Mm-hmm. We shall see.
If you need the AO3 bitches, I've got a hookup.
I didn't even know that was like a, like, I'm also on AO3, but apparently I've been engaging with it like a boomer as well.
Fanfic,
but I did not know that you could just be like, here's a survey, take it, because there are lots of monster fuckers on AO3.
I have a lot of friends who are very active on AO3 and they're into some weird shit, so.
Yeah, I want them. The weirder, I want them. Okay. I want people that, like, I hear something and I'm like, I will pray for you.
I will light the perv bat signal.
Like, so that's the thing, is that I was talking with someone who was also doing a research project on monstrosity and attraction to monsters, and they are like a veteran Tumblr, and suddenly I felt like such an imposter in their presence, because they're like, yeah, Tumblr, we have like hierarchies and we have levels and, you know, we have all these things, and we don't think that like monster romance, like, we, like, people sneer at that. And I'm like, oh, Tumblr, you are a place.
You are a place that
exists. You exist. You exist. And, you know, it's so funny to me because, like, on one hand, like, what are we gatekeeping this for? It's such a silly thing. What do you gain by gatekeeping? But on the other hand, some of the things I see on Tumblr, I'm like, yeah.
Keep it behind the gate.
Yeah, I'm like, this is, like, we're, like, some people are playing peewee baseball, and these folks are in, like, the big leagues. Like,
yeah.
Different.
It's like, to quote The Office, like, even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Yeah, you know, and you know, you look at it and you're just like, oh wow, okay. But again, I want to hear from you. I want your opinion. You matter.
Yeah, so we will have all your links everywhere, but where is like the first place that people can find you if they want to follow your work?
Yeah, so you can see all of my work on my website, themonstrousdesirestudy.com. You know, my name. And if you want to stay engaged and up to date, you can sign up for emails. And I keep them to like one email a week. So don't worry about me flooding your inbox. Pretty much if you sign up for email, I just... I let you know about when I update the blog, any sort of progress on the book, any sort of merch drops, etc. There's that. You can also go on Spotify to listen to my podcast, themonstrousdesirestudy.com, or no, that is my website title, but it is The Monstrous Desire Study.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty safe to say if you look up that handle on TikTok and Instagram, I will also be there under that handle as well. So yes, you can find me on TikTok, on Instagram, on Google, on Spotify, on Apple. I will be there.
AO3 bitches signed up to the newsletter.
Get sound the horn.
The perv bat signal. That's gonna be rally living rent free up here for a while.
Yeah. So yeah. So thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on. This has been a delight.
I am very happy to be here and to chat with both of you.
Can't wait to hear about the book news when it comes. We will be pre-ordering.
Thank you. Very exciting.
All right. We will have all of Ella's links in the show notes. We will have all of our links in the show notes. So until next time, air kisses.
Bye.
Bye.